This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell is explicitly blaming outgoing President Donald Trump for the deadly riot at the U.S. Capitol, saying the mob was fed lies and that the president and others provoked those intent on overturning Democrat Joe Biden's election. Ahead of Mr. Trump's historic second impeachment trial, McConnell's remarks were his first severe and public rebuke of the outgoing president. The GOP leader is setting a tone as Republicans weigh whether to convict Mr. Trump on the impeachment charge that will soon be sent over from the House, incitement and insurrection. The Republican leader vowed a safe and successful inauguration for Joe Biden on Wednesday at the Capitol, where final preparations were underway amid heavy security. Meanwhile, in a farewell video, U.S. President Donald Trump is wishing his successor well. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
The president acknowledges he'll hand over powers to a new administration.
We extend our best wishes.
He never said Joe Biden's name in a 20-minute video released shortly after Biden arrived outside Washington, instead touting his own administration's achievements.
Nobody thought we could even come close.
The president will skip inauguration and instead fly to Florida. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Hours from inauguration, President-elect Joe Biden paused on what might be his entrance to Washington on Tuesday to mark instead the national tragedy of the coronavirus pandemic with a moment of collective grief for Americans lost. His arrival coincided with the awful news that the U.S. death toll had surpassed 400,000 in the worst public health crisis in more than a century. Crisis Biden will now be charged with controlling. This is VOA News. 12 U.S. National Guard members have been removed from securing President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration after vetting by the FBI, including two who posted extremist views about the Wednesday event. There was no specific threat to Biden. Two U.S. officials told the Associated Press that all 12 were found to have ties with the right-wing militia groups or posted extremist views online. The officials, a senior intelligence official and an Army official briefed on the matter, did not say which fringe groups the Guard members belonged to or what unit they served in. The officials were not authorized to speak publicly and spoke to the AP on condition of anonymity. German Chancellor Angela Merkel and state premiers agreed on Tuesday to extend the lockdown for most shops and schools until February 14th as part of a package of steps to try to rein in the coronavirus. They also agreed to mandate medical masks rather than simple cotton ones on public transportation and in stores. The existing lockdown runs until January 31st. New infections have been decreasing in recent days, and pressure on intensive care units have eased slightly, but virologists are worried about the possible spread of more infectious variants of the novel coronavirus. Merkel said all countries in Europe must make similar efforts to fight the pandemic. Otherwise, Germany may consider restricting border entry to avoid highly transmissible strains being brought in from abroad. Italian Premier Giuseppe Conte has won a crucial confidence vote in the Senate, keeping his wobbly coalition afloat for now, but without the reliable support he needs to help effectively govern a country reeling from the pandemic. The vote Tuesday night went from 156 to 140 in his favor, with 16 abstentions, mainly from a coalition ally that bolted the government last week. Had Conte lost, he would have had to resign. Republican lawmakers in the United States and conservative groups are opposing President-elect Joe Biden's forthcoming immigration plan as massive amnesty for people in the U.S. illegally. Their opposition underscores that the measures will face an uphill fight in Congress and that Democrats control just narrowly. In a further complication, several pro-immigration groups say they'll press Biden to go even further and take steps such as immediate moratorium on deportations. Find more at voanews.com via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatey in Washington. Today is Wednesday, January 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda accuses the U.S. of meddling in Ugandan politics.
We all know that Ambassador Natadi and the American system here, you say that so on, has been funding Bobi Wine and other outfits in the clear disregard of diplomatic norms. The main objective to destabilize the government of Uganda and cause regime change.
Africa Elections Watch calls for an independent audit of Uganda's election. Hundreds are arrested after a third night of rioting in parts of Tunisia. Somalia says security cooperation will continue despite U.S. troop withdrawal. Coronavirus cases are down in South Africa, but scientists say a new variant is more transmissible. And the UN issues life-saving appeal for people threatened by hunger and COVID-19 in Madagascar.
The food security analysis from last month, December, also showed the alarming projection, more than 135,000 children under the age of five suffering from acute malnutrition in the coming months.
And firearms and illegal drug trafficking in West Africa. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Uganda has accused the United States of meddling in its internal politics and supporting the opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP, party. The comments came after security forces blocked the U.S. ambassador's attempt to visit detained NUP leader Bobi Wine, who has been under a de facto house arrest since the election that gave President Yoweri Museveni a sixth term. Halima Altumani reports from Kampala.
Since Election Day on January 14th, police and soldiers have kept NUP leader Robert Kyagulanyi, better known as Bobi Wine, confined to his house on the outskirts of Kampala. The U.S. ambassador to Uganda, Natalie Brown, attempted to meet with the musician-turned-politician on Monday, but was turned away. According to a statement by the U.S. embassy, the ambassador had gone to check on the health and welfare of Wine, given that he has been unable to leave his home. U.S. Embassy spokesperson Tony Kujawa said the visit to Wine's home was part of U.S. diplomatic engagements with different actors across Uganda's political spectrum.
Uganda's election campaigns were marred by the harassment of opposition candidates, campaign staff and supporters, suppression of the media and civil society activities, and a nationwide internet shutdown before, during and after voting day. These unlawful actions and the effective house arrest of a presidential candidate continue a worrying trend on the course of Uganda's democracy.
But government spokesman Ofwono Opondo says the ambassador is neither a social worker nor a healthcare provider and does not qualify to check on anybody's health or welfare. He says Brown is an accredited diplomat in Uganda, and if there's any place she wants to visit, she must seek clearance from Uganda Foreign Affairs Ministry, which she didn't. He also accused the U.S. of supporting the NUP.
Obviously, we all know that Ambassador Natadi and the American system here, you say that so on, has been funding Bobi Wine and other outfits in clear disregard of diplomatic norms, with the main objective to destabilize the government of Uganda and cause regime change outside the constitutional framework. We are watching her back. You can tell her that.
Mathias Mpuuga, the NUP's vice president, denied the party is getting money from the U.S. government.
What is true is that so many Ugandan diaspora have been contributing to our struggle, and they continue to do so. That we can't deny. I can tell you, even an insane person at this stage would be concerned about the welfare of the Honorable Kyagulanyi and his family.
Bobi Wine and his wife filed a lawsuit Tuesday against Uganda's Attorney General, Chief of Defense Forces, and the Inspector General Police. The couple say they have been held incommunicado since the election with no access to visitors, lawyers, and family members. They are asking the court to order security forces to pull back from their house or for police to present charges against them in a court of law. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Africa Elections Watch, a non-governmental organization, has condemned what it calls massive electoral malpractices and gross human rights violation during Uganda's January 14 presidential election. The Ugandan Electoral Commission says longtime President Yoweri Museveni won a sixth term. As Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, Africa Elections Watch is calling on regional and international organizations to commence an independent audit of the Ugandan election.
The group, which comprises Kenya Human Rights Commission, Amnesty International, Haki Africa, among others, says it sent in over 2,000 election monitors across Uganda and that the election was not fair and credible based on documented incidents and reports from the election monitors. John Gidongo is the chief executive officer of Inuka Kenya, or Rise Up Kenya, a member of the Africa Elections Watch.
Africa Elections Watch is a coalition of organizations and individuals working on the continent's electoral issues, including monitoring, observation, and advocacy. Africa Elections Watch had over 2,000 election monitors in the Uganda general elections. The coalition has documented widespread violations of human rights as well as deliberate disregard of the election process, and I meant human rights abuses.
Gidongo also says there were widespread human rights violations during the election process.
The announcement of Yoweri Museveni as the winner of the presidential election comes in the wake of widespread human rights violations that are already documented. President Yoweri Museveni and his administration have, among other things, mismanaged the election, suppressed the right to freedom of expression through an internet and social media shutdown, used the security forces, including the military deployment, to intimidate members of the political opposition and their supporters ahead of and during the election. They've intimidated the media through state violence and direct intimidation of journalist personnel. The state has also suppressed scrutiny and accountability through physical attacks, arrests, and other forms of coercion against opposition party agents, human rights defenders, and election observers.
Kenya Human Rights Commission Acting Executive Director Davis Malombe says Africa Elections Watch has sufficient reason to discredit the results of the election process. He called upon regional and international bodies to rise up and speak up for Uganda.
Indeed, there's sufficient reason to poke holes into both the results and the entire process, which is why the African Election Watch is asking regional and international bodies like the African Union, East African Community, the European Union, and the governments, regional and international human rights organizations, to rise up and speak out with and for already suppressed Ugandans. Silence will kill Uganda, and this silence will embolden other leaders, especially in the region, to take a similar route to muzzle the voice of the people and deny them the right to elect their leaders of choice in a free, fair, and a just way. And also, this also justifies why we are also intervening in Uganda as Kenyans and also as Africans.
Main opposition presidential candidate Robert Chagulanyi, also known as Bobi Wine, who lost the election, says Ugandan government has placed him under house arrest. Wine has rejected the results, saying the process was full of illegalities and irregularities. His lawyers have petitioned the Uganda High Court to set him free. The Electoral Commission says that about 7 million Ugandans did not vote in the January 14 election. The commission gives no reason. However, Africa Elections Watch has alleged that Ugandans who did not vote did so because they were intimidated by the heavy military presence during the polls. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
Riots and looting were reported late Monday in a number of Tunisian towns and cities, leading to the arrest of nearly 600 people. Widespread rioting began early Sunday, days after the country marked the 10th anniversary of the resignation of longtime President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali in Tunisia's 2011 Arab Spring Revolution. Edward Urania reports for VOA from Cairo.
Tunisian security forces fired tear gas at crowds of protesters Tuesday afternoon in the center of the capital, Tunis, as they marched towards the Interior Ministry, demanding the release of those arrested after 3 nights of rioting and looting in towns and cities across the country. Crowds of young men attacked and looted businesses, government offices, and banks again Monday night. Security forces arrested about 600 people in the wake of violence and demands by the public to protect private property. Tunisian President Kais Saied walked the streets of the capital, Tunis, Monday to urge young people to demonstrate peacefully and not to attack public or private property. He tells a crowd of young people they have the right to express their opinions peacefully, but ask them not to attack public or private property when they do so. Ayashi Zemel, a member of the Tunisian parliament, told Al Hora TV that social and economic conditions in the country have deteriorated due to the COVID-19 crisis and that people are angry because politicians are playing political games instead of addressing the problems of ordinary people. Egyptian political sociologist Saeed Sadiq, who is in Tunisia, tells VOA that rioting has become a regular event each year to mark the 2011 fall of the Zain al-Abidine Ben Ali regime.
Those kind of riots are expected every year since the revolution. Before the revolution, you would not be able to do what they were doing today, because the Ben Ali regime was a police state and they would not allow this to happen.
Sadiq argues that discord between the country's three top leaders, President Kais Saied, Prime Minister Hisham Mashishi, and Parliament Speaker Rashid Al-Ghanouchi, who heads the Islamist Al-Nahda party, is a major factor behind the latest disturbances. Khatara Boudiab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA that some analysts are calling the latest rioting a new Arab Spring revolution, not unlike the one that shook Tunisia, Egypt, Syria, and Libya in 2011, but he doubts that is the case.
Est-ce qu'on peut parler 10 ans après?
He says this is not a resumption of the Arab Spring, but rather ordinary disturbances caused by poverty, marginalization, and despair. Young people, he argues, expected change after the Ben Ali regime fell, and now all they see is a black hole. The Muslim Brotherhood's Al-Nahda party, he says, is trying to make itself into the main power broker in Tunisia and would like to set up an authoritarian regime under the camouflage of a multi-party system. Abu Diab goes on to argue, however, that Al-Nahda has lost much of its clout since the fall of the Ben Ali regime, along with many of its members and a good part of its credibility. Nevertheless, he adds, they're still good at political maneuvering. The Tunisian government announced a four-day lockdown last week, which it said was due to a surge in the number of COVID-19 cases. Some analysts, however, say the lockdown is meant to prevent possible violence on the 10th anniversary of the January 14th departure of former President Ben Ali. Tunisia has been facing serious economic problems in the 10 years since the departure of Ben Ali, and the recent COVID-19 crisis has left the country with a budget shortfall. The first Arab Spring Revolution broke out in Tunisia in December 2010 after a young vegetable seller by the name of Mohamed Bouazizi set himself on fire to protest economic conditions and alleged police brutality. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, January 20th. The U.S. withdrawal of troops training Somalia's elite forces has raised concerns about security and instability in the country. But Somali officials and analysts say the country will still count on U.S. air power against al-Shabaab militants. Mohamed Kahir reports from Mogadishu.
Somali Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble and senior defense officials in his government toured Ballydoble Air Base south of the capital Mogadishu this month to thank U.S. forces before they withdrew. The United States Africa Command on Sunday confirmed the estimated 700 U.S. troops in Somalia had been repositioned in the region as ordered by President Donald Trump. Officials say security cooperation between the United States and Somali forces reduced the threat from Islamist militant group al-Shabaab. Somalia's Information Minister Osman Dube says he expects U.S. military assistance will continue after this week's pullout.
He says the withdrawal of U.S. troops is not a permanent decision, nor is it the end of the security and military cooperation. It's normal technical maneuver. He says adding that cooperation with Washington has been strengthening in recent years. Somali officials say U.S. training and drone strikes targeting al-Shabaab leaders and gatherings reduced hit-and-run attacks against African peacekeepers and Somali politicians. No disruption is expected in the use of drone strikes, which the United States controls from outside of Somalia. But the security analysts worry the pullout of U.S. troops will give the militants an excuse to launch fresh attacks on international targets like African Union peacekeepers. Abdisalam Guled is former deputy director of Somali National Intelligence.
I think it will be very difficult for them to operate without the support of Americans. Not only the Somalis, but the African peacekeepers will suffer, and the Somalis will suffer more. The African peacekeepers and the Somalis were getting more support from the Americans over, you know, the support of drones were helping a lot. That managed to Al-Shabaab not be able to use all the military capability and capacity.
With withdrawal of American troops just ahead of next month's presidential and parliamentary elections, security concerns have been growing. Veteran Somali lawmaker Mohamed Omar Talha says international security support must be maintained. He says terrorism is not only a threat to our region, it's a global threat which needs an international response that fills the gap left behind. Talha says they hope the new U.S. president will renew Washington's security role in Somalia. The U.S. military said its troops in Somalia will be repositioned in the region, with its military base in Djibouti and a shared air base in Kenya as likely options. Mohamed Kahir for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
The United Nations is launching a $76 million flash appeal to provide life-saving humanitarian aid for more than 1 million people in Madagascar who are threatened by drought-induced hunger and the growing impact of COVID-19. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
3 years of consecutive drought, compounded by the COVID-19 pandemic, is creating a hunger and humanitarian crisis in Madagascar. Seasonal harvests in the country's Grand Sud region have been wiped out by recurrent drought in the last 10 years. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs is urgently appealing for international support to help 1.1 million people in desperate need of life-saving assistance. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says they face huge and potentially life-threatening needs for food, nutrition, water and sanitation, and medical care.
The food security analysis from last month, December, also showed the alarming projection of more than 135,000 children under the age of five suffering from acute malnutrition in the coming months in the Grand Sud.
Laerke says the COVID-19 pandemic also is affecting a large part of the country and driving many people to the brink of survival. He says COVID-19 lockdowns have destroyed the normal mechanisms people have relied upon to see them through the lean season, which runs from November to March. This is the period in the year when food is most scarce. Traditionally, people would migrate to the cities in search of work during the lean season. Laerke says they would send their earnings home to sustain their families throughout this difficult period.
With COVID-19, this kind of coping mechanism is no longer available because people cannot move and there are no jobs available. So besides the direct health implication of this, these secondary effects that make, that takes away people's normal ways of dealing with crises of this sort has also been undermined.
If funded, the UN will have money to improve food security for more than 1 million people and provide safe water and healthcare services for hundreds of thousands of people, as well as life-saving nutritional support for 300,000 malnourished young children. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Africa is reporting both good and bad news in the nation's battle against the coronavirus. The health minister Tuesday noted a decline in confirmed cases, but the head of the coronavirus task force warns a new variant is more transmissible than earlier versions. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
First, the good news from South Africa's health minister, Dr. Zweli Mkhize.
The nation is still experiencing its second wave of the virus. But in the past week, Mkhize said the Rainbow Nation saw a 23% decline in confirmed cases. And now for the more concerning news. The head of the nation's coronavirus task force, epidemiologist Dr. Salim Abdul-Karim, says a new variant of the virus, known as 501V2, is spreading quickly in South Africa.
Its affinity and its ability to bind to the human cell is now stronger. And that's what enables it to become a more efficient virus in the way it transmits. So this drastic change that we're seeing is being driven by a virus that certainly biologically looks like it can attach to human cells more efficiently.
He said recent tests are showing a much higher percentage of positive results than doctors saw in the first wave in the first half of last year. But he adds scientists haven't concluded that this variant is more severe. In fact, he said, current data suggests it is not. And he quickly allayed fears that the 1.5 million vaccine doses expected to land in South Africa by February won't work on this new strain.
I will not even attempt to speculate on that matter. I'll wait for the data. And certainly, we have no empiric evidence yet on whether vaccines are effective against this variant. Those studies are well underway.
And in a rare departure from science, Dr. Karim took a moment to talk politics, urging against calling this mutation the South Africa variant. When researchers first spotted this new variant, they were careful not to call it that in scientific papers. He explained why this matters.
There are variants across the world. And even if they're found in one country, we don't even know if that's where they originated from. And they will rapidly spread to many countries. The B117 is now in almost 50 countries. The 501YV2 variant is already available in more than 10 countries. Just like how we objected when the US president called SARS-CoV-2 the China virus, we should not call this variant by its country. We should call it by its name.
What does all this new science mean for the average South African? Not much, doctors said. Their basic guidance remains the same. Prevent transmission by staying home if you can, distance from others, wash your hands, and always wear a mask in public. Anita Pal, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Operation CAFO 2, launched late last year by Interpol and the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, the UNODC, took place across four West African countries. It involved 260 law enforcement agents who seized 50 firearms, along with fake medicines and explosives that were destined to be used in gold mines to help fund extremist activities in the Sahel. Leonardo Lara, a crime prevention and criminal justice officer at the UNODC, spoke to Ricky Stryak about why the operation was launched.
People tend to forget about the weapons. Where are these weapons coming from? Where were they lost? Where were they originally? What was their original intention? And basically, this is the idea why we have been doing this, is to also focus on the weapons and try to get to the bottom of the origin of these illicit weapons. So, we can stop the trafficking.
What was discovered about the origins and what kind of firearms were these? Because also, one of my questions would be, a lot of these groups operate in quite rural areas where some of these firearms also used for hunting.
What I can tell you is that there were different kinds of weapons that were seized, from automatic weapons to also artisanal weapons. So we have both kinds. But this is actually, it's actually a very important point, because, again, this is also, one of the main issues. I mean, what is out there? One of the reasons why also we do these operations is so that national authorities also can improve their work in identifying weapons and, in determining the kind of weapons that are being used, so that information, the information flow is better.
This operation involved over 200 law enforcement officials, and there were 50 firearms seized. Would some say that that's not that many firearms, but you're stressing that it's not about that necessarily. I mean, of course, it's about that a little bit, but it's also about the understanding that gives law enforcement officials about how these groups are operating. Is that correct?
That is correct, and I'm actually glad that you mentioned that, because yes, indeed, I mean, we have, you know, we are working in four countries. We have, you know, more than 250 people involved from different law enforcement organizations.
That was Leolando Lara, a crime prevention and criminal justice officer at the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Vienna. And that's it for this Wednesday, January 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a good day.